CliffCentral.com.
Good morning, everyone. First thing in the morning. Not the greatest. It's not the worst, but it's not the greatest. I was thinking about those people who have to wake up and catch like 20 taxis to wherever they're going, and then I'm like, yes, you know. Actually, we don't have it so bad. Mm-hmm. Feel sorry for yourself for like 5 minutes, and then you have to get over it, you know. Get on with your life. Well, there's lots to talk about this morning. I listened to the most interesting podcast yesterday. It's probably about a year and a half old. It's an English dude who does this show called Modern Wisdom. He was talking to a guy about using devices and technology and how enslaved we are to this stuff, you know, and I'm sure everybody knows exactly what we mean. See, it looks like you've frozen on your side.
Frozen.
Visually, anyway.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and not because of the cold, for a change.
Yeah. Let me go back in and out.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world, but we're just seeing, like, one of your ears and half your face. So, this guy was saying, and Simpiwe is with us this morning, by the way. If you don't recognize the lovely Simpiwe, she is in the studio taking care of things there, as she does every morning. And this morning, she's also a part of the show, which we like to have more often than you think. And Simpiwe is just she's very difficult to peg down for this stuff. She's always like, oh, I don't want to do this.
Yes, you know, I have to be a diva. Well, yeah. What's the point, you know?
So this guy.
Make you guys beg and worry.
I know. Well, we do. We have to beg. So this dude, he's basically, he's written a book about how we overuse technology and we shouldn't sleep with our phones next to us. In fact, he says when you sleep at night, the phone shouldn't even be in the same room as you. Now, I don't know about you, but that's going to be very difficult for me. You know, I mean, I live on my own. It's one of the ways I wake up. It's my alarm for a start. So, and I know it's ridiculous to think, well, you know, if people need to get hold of you and it's urgent, how are they going to get hold of you? But, you know, how many people are seriously for, you know, that one occasion in 20 years that someone calls you with an emergency in the middle of the night? Doesn't happen often, right?
Yeah, but I think people just feel guilty that they didn't answer the call, they didn't see the message. Right. And I think it's more out of guilt than them actually being like, oh, I need to have my phone right next to me. But also, it's my alarm. Like, if you can provide another alarm for me, hey, I'll take it.
Well, I've got one of those old, you know, those old alarm clocks, those metal ones that ring and they've got the two little bells on the top and everything, like you see in a cartoon.
Oh my gosh, like in the cartoons.
Those ones. So I've got one of those. No, seriously, I got one of those, but I haven't used it in years because I use my phone as my alarm. And, you know, CS sends me a message to make sure I'm not dead every morning at like 5:30. And
it's also a sign of life for me.
Yeah, sure. No, I know, but this guy was saying that you shouldn't sleep with your phone in the same room as you, because he says there's, you know, if there's a real emergency, people will find some other way of getting hold of you or you'll get the message. But he says during dinner, when you eat dinner at night, you should not have your phone anywhere near you. Because
I agree.
It's rude of people to, first of all, call you while you're, you know, could be eating dinner and while you're spending time with your family or with friends or whatever it is, or even if you're just eating dinner on your own. He says it's good to have some time where you're nowhere near your phone. And this guy is saying, like, all these apps and all these games and social media are designed, and we know this already, this is not news, he says they're designed to keep you there forever, for as long as possible. That's why you could scroll on Instagram, and you never get to the end of the scroll. Have you noticed that? There's always something. You know, it can go on for eternally and infinitely. And that, he says, just keeps you there forever. And because we're humans, we like to finish a task. So we like to know when something's done. And Instagram's never done. Mm-hmm. And Facebook's never done. There's always more stuff coming up at the bottom. And he said, that stuff is not good for you. So I just thought it was interesting, you know.
I've never thought about it like that, and I've never heard of these social media companies having psychologists, but I'm sure they consult with psychologists to figure out human behavior, what appeals to people and how to keep their people coming back. I would assume they definitely did something like that.
No,
of course. I mean, if you look at how colors and how we like, they say if something's on a blue background, you tend to read it more and things like that. So like colors even play a big part in how you just interact with something. So I agree with you there, Sia, that
definitely
there's more to it. There's more to it. They want us to be there.
It's funny you raise that example now of having dinner. I had dinner with my sister yesterday.
Yeah.
And as we were having dinner, I realized this actually is a bit of a, I'm stuck in this pattern where I thought something's missing. And even though it was her and I, and we had a meal in front of us, I thought something feels off. Something's missing. Then I realized, oh, the TV's switched off.
Oh.
That's why it just feels.
That's so great.
I'm so used to not even just watching the television, but at least just having that background noise. And it felt so weird to me that I opted to play music in the background just to have something. But yeah, I'm.
Does it make you I just want to, break this down for a second. So, does it make you uncomfortable when there isn't something going on in the background?
Yes,
this is a new revelation, so it's news to me as well. But yeah, somewhat, I guess. I'm not one of those people, you know, I have a friend who's on the opposite side of the scale as well, who always needs to have the TV on in the background.
Yeah.
Even when they go into a hotel room, the first thing they do is switch the TV on and then they can go about doing other things. I'm not that bad, but I guess it's a bit of a pattern for me. You know, the fact that I live largely alone, you know, my roommate, believe it or not, has more of a social life than me.
No, I can't
believe
it. Usually
alone for dinner.
Okay. No, but you see, I like...
So I'm usually alone for meals and I'm usually watching something, you know?
Yeah. I think...
Okay.
I really think that we've got to find a way of just disconnecting from this stuff some of the time. I'm not saying, like, it's all bad. I'm not one of those people who's going to declare that I'm not using my phone. You can only get me between these hours and... It's bullshit. That's never going to happen, right?
But yeah, I actually had a friend who was like that. You could only contact her between like 8 and 5 o'clock during work hours. And then after that, nothing at all. And it was very weird. We're just like, but what happens after 5?
You kind of, you have to respect, where are you? You sort of have to respect those rules. She's almost like, okay, sorry, I'm only available during those times. So it's like office hours. And if you think about it, so apparently there's a company in Germany who has started experimenting with only delivering emails during office hours. So if Sia sends me something at 2 in the morning, I'll only get it when I wake up at 7 o'clock or whatever, 6, 7 o'clock. And they'll actually hold it back and then send a batch of emails when your working day starts. Because there is this expectation that just because Sia sends something at 2 a.m. means I should be doing it at 3 a.m. And I do think that's wrong. I think that first of all, that's a kind of abuse by whatever your workplace is or even your boss. I mean, you know, there are occasions where we all have to do, something in a rush, but you know, if you've got to work through the night to complete a project for a deadline, that's different to just sending people emails because you're awake and they're not. I think there's something abusive about that actually. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I have a funny story. So there was a company that after I left Shift Central, I worked for, and there was this guy, a graphic designer, who would send emails at like 2 o'clock in the morning to say, hi guys, I won't be coming into the office today.
Right.
I won't be able to attend today's meetings. Please excuse me. And then you look and you're like, wait, you sent this at 2 o'clock in the morning when we arrive in the office. We're like, what were you doing at 2 o'clock in the morning? Why were you up at 2 o'clock in the morning? How did you even know you're not coming into the office? And it was just always like eye raising, like, So yeah.
Well, there's a thing that people do that they show off how busy they are, you know, and how hard they work. And they do these weird things to get like everybody else to go, oh, you know, Simpiwa works really hard. At 2 a.m, she was sending me emails. Like, that shouldn't be normal. We shouldn't be treating that with respect. We should be saying, That's not necessary. If you've got your life together and you've got a work-life balance and you actually have a reason to keep office hours and all the rest of it, and, you know, you take your job seriously, you shouldn't be sending that stuff at 2 a.m. And I don't care who you are, unless you work night shift. Like, 2 a.m. is not a time where you should be discussing things with people at work. I mean, how can you expect that they're up and they're still doing things? It's crazy, right?
I disagree, just because of the times changing and certain roles and responsibilities being necessary for certain jobs.
Yeah.
For example, I've had a guest send me a message at 2 a.m. and say that they are so ill they can't make an interview. I will not name and shame, but anyways.
Yeah.
Then I get the ping, and yeah. I'm up. Hey, am I not stressing for the next hour trying
to get
back?
Yeah, but you see, like, yeah, that's crazy. No. You should be allowed to have your sleep. You should be allowed to have a life. Nobody belongs to their job.
I would rather know that then, because I was able to formulate some sort of a backup plan by 6 a.m. It's just part and parcel of what we have to deal with. Perhaps I could institute something different in order to have some sort of balance. But, you know, it was actually Michael Jordan who gave me my big moment of realization when he came in for an interview. It's a great interview. I am promoting our own show while we're on the show.
You're allowed to. It's very self-serving.
Shameless plug.
Go ahead. Yes. Sir, you do that.
Go back and listen to that interview.
Right.
Where he said he has a set time at the beginning of the workday where he deals with emails.
Right.
And only then he goes about with his agenda for the day.
I know. Look, some people can do that. It's easy to do that when you are Michael Jordan, and you know you're in charge of your own life. Like, some people have to do what their company asks them to do, especially if you're a 24/7 sort of person. You're running social media accounts, which is what Simpiwe does some of the time. So you have to be awake to whatever's going on. But I do think, like, I, for example, don't get emails on my phone. That's one of – I just draw a line there. I don't have Twitter on my phone. I don't have email on my phone. I don't have Facebook on my phone. I do have WhatsApp because WhatsApp is used for, you know, we all have WhatsApp groups for work and we all have WhatsApp groups for our friends. And I've muted all my friend WhatsApp groups for a year. You know, you can mute them for a year because those aren't important. I can get to those when I get to those. You know, if I miss out someone.
Then you get to them and there's 153 messages.
Then you know what? Then they've missed me for all of that. And I'm sure they'll be all right. It's like you can't make every party. Yeah. If you think about it, compare it to real social occasions. You can't make every single dinner or party or drinks night or whatever it is that you go to. So you miss out on those too. Too bad. You can't have this fear of missing out for things like that. It's deeply, deeply unhealthy. This guy was saying basically you have to make your own rules. And there are people who feel like they need to increase their productivity all the time. And then there are those people who go, you know what? And he said, by the way, it's mostly the people who are very tech-minded, the people who actually work in tech, who have the strictest rules of all. And their rules are like, you don't call me during dinner. I'm not available. And I will set up email so that I check it twice a day, or that I only check it on my laptop. I don't check it on my phone. There are people who will not, they won't respond to Slack messages at certain times either. You know, there are these Slack apps that we use for work as well. And I think that that's all very, it's good. You have to decide, you know, like, for example, in your life, you're not going to have toxic people, or you're not going to go to places where, you know, there are, you know, people who are taking drugs all around you or whatever. You make those decisions in your life, and then you've got to make the same sort of decisions in your professional life. I know that there are jobs that are the exceptions. I'm not being an idiot here. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that you need to put unrealistic rules in place, but I think we can do this, you know. I mean, here's Lito, who's often on the Burning Platform with us, says, stop habitually grabbing your phone. I leave angry YouTube comments in my spare time. Stop eating avocado. That's great. That's so great.
I don't know if we need to go that far.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen. I mean, here's Tracy. She says, it's rude when someone answers their phone while they're having dinner with you. I've done that, and I know it's rude, but I've still done it. And Desiree says something. I think this is also true. I feel that that is just life now, she says. I believe we need to be more accepting that we're a technology-driven generation. No one wants to live like they're in the 1800s. We want to live in the now. I get that, but we're missing out on actual living by being on a screen the whole time. You know, these screens will kill us. I'm telling you, kids. So here's the thing he said that really grabbed me, and I think this might just make you guys think differently about this too, because I thought I'm not going to be able to change a lot of these habits. It's just the way I live. He said children are growing up and they cannot pick up on soft emotional cues. Like they can't tell the difference between anger, frustration, irritation, sarcasm, irony, humor. They can't tell the difference between a smile, which is like a really happy smile, or a smile, which is sarcastic, for example, because they've never learned this stuff socially. They're used to doing it on screens now. I'm not talking about small kids. I'm talking about people who've grown up with phones. So they're in their 20s now. But they started using phones when they were like, I don't know, 12, 13. And they've done research on these kids, and they cannot understand. So, for example, they would be useless at playing poker with you because they don't know what it means when you've got a poker face, or when you give away little emotional cues, little clues as to what you're actually feeling. They can't interpret those things at all because they're used to doing most of that through a screen. And this has been intensified by masks and by the fact that we now do Zoom meetings and all of that stuff, because there's a huge difference. You guys know this. I mean, you understand when you're with someone, you pick up on body language a whole lot better than when they're on a screen, right? We all know this. Yeah. So he says what happens is you've actually got a generation who are worse at interpreting other people's moods, emotions, and intentions than the generation before them because of technology. So I get what Desiree is saying, but that's what I found really, really scary, because it means almost like those people who didn't grow up with the phone around them all the time, those people have like a superpower over the others because they can interpret these little things. Like you can see if someone's, you know, looking that way, for example, what that means. Whereas someone who's grown up with phones is like, what's going on? What's going on? I don't understand. They're a bit lost.
But then what's Peppa Pig and Ben 10 actually teaching them?
Nothing, Sia.
That's a good question.
Oh. I hate to tell you. That's a good question. Probably nothing. Those shows are not, I mean, I didn't learn a whole lot about life from cartoons. I learned some things, but not a whole lot. Listen to what Linda says. Linda says, my work phone goes on silent at 8 p.m., goes back on 7:30 a.m. I often wake up to messages from people who work late or very early, and they send things so they don't forget. Yeah, that's also what people do when they CC you on an email. It's so they don't forget.
Mm-hmm. I'm still stuck. She has a work phone. Like, wow, shout out to you for having two phones.
Yeah.
That can't be me.
Yeah. I tried having two phones for about a year. It was probably 10 years ago, and it was just way too much work. That's double the work. And you know, these people who put these, they have like different devices for different purposes and things. That can get so complicated to manage. You spend your whole day just managing your technology, which is no good.
Yeah, it's still a little backward of me to think like this. But I think if you have two phones, it's slightly sketchy.
Yeah, I agree.
What are you hiding?
Yeah. I know one person who has two phones, and I also think they're sketchy as hell. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't blame you.
Nico says, here's an update for your WhatsApp. You can now mute people for always. In other words, forever. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, listen, some stuff you don't need the notifications. Notifications are part of the – I mean, that's – like when your phone goes off while you're driving, you can't help but look at that notification, right? You can't help it, and it's so dangerous.
I don't know anyone who does what some people have preached, the whole when you get into your car, put your phone in your boot, and then you drive. I have never known anyone who's tried that before because I think it's great on paper. But not an actual reality. No. And as much as I could, I would love to live this life of being away from my phone more often.
Yeah.
I also, if I'm not around my phone, or for example, I tried not having emails on my phone, I also have this feeling of being out of the loop. I wouldn't exactly call it FOMO, but I just feel like I'm out of the loop. I'm not on it. I'm not.
Well, you're also.
I'm not on point. I don't know.
You're a very polite person. And this guy was saying, for example, that socially now it's considered rude if you don't respond on a WhatsApp group or you don't respond to an email. You know, he said there's an element of like, you're not being polite. You're not being socially acceptable. And that would bother you, Sia. Like you usually respond. Even if it's just to say thank you, got your email or whatever, you're pretty good with that stuff. A lot of people.
Yeah, the texting part, I don't have much of a.
No, but
I don't feel guilty about. But email, yeah.
I feel like that. So I use that. You know when you can pin a WhatsApp to the top of the screen. You can. I think you swipe left or right or whatever, and you can pin something. So if I have to get back to someone about something important, not something stupid. Then I'll pin it and it sits at the top of my WhatsApp until I've dealt with it. And that's one way. But you can only pin three, so I'm always like, oh, I've got to decide which three are the most important. And you know, sometimes you get a lot of messages in a day, so it's quite a lot to think about.
Is it normal that this conversation is giving me slight anxiety now?
No, it should be. Why? Because this is exactly what the guy's saying. This is precisely what happens to people, is that they don't know how to manage this stuff, right? And it drives some people wild. They don't know what to do with it.
I want to hear from people who work in environments where they can't have their phones.
Like, yes.
I know. Like, if you're a surgeon, you're away from your phone for like 3 or 4 hours when you're operating on someone. Aren't there certain like departments in the bank where you can't walk in with your phone, so you'd have to like declare and hand it over? Yeah. Imagine that for 8 hours, just not.
Well, I mean.
But I think you get used to it because it's part of the job. And then I have a friend who's a doctor, and best believe when she's out of surgery, she'll be posting the WhatsApp statuses. She'll be like replying to all the things. Yeah. Like you can tell she is back on life. Like, so you just kind of get used to it to be like, oh, next 8 hours.
So this one guy in the podcast says he's got two phones. Again, I can't manage that, but he says he does. So his one phone is connected to Wi-Fi only, and that's the one that he can get social media on. And he only uses that in Wi-Fi. The other phone is for messages and for email and for phoning people, for actually calling people. So the one phone he carries around with him. Wherever he goes, and it's got, you know, it can connect to the internet by network. The other one's only for Wi-Fi. So I don't know how that works, but again, to me, it sounds almost like you're complicating your life even more.
Yes. Like, I also don't get people who have, like, a WhatsApp number and then they have a calling number. And it's just like, you complicating my life. I don't understand. What?
Admin.
Who's in the zoo? Like, no. Just pick a struggle. Have one number. That's it. Like, that's my two cents.
So, Bichleng manages his emails like this. I don't read emails from my phone. All incoming calls are blocked. Colleagues and friends complain, and now they get it. They send me a text first, and I'll decide whether I call back or not. Well, lucky you that you have colleagues who will put up with that, because I wouldn't work with you. I'd be like, if I can't get hold of you, then what's the point of working with you? You know, you have to be reasonable as well, Bichleng. But obviously, you're in charge. I mean, like, Bichleng can't possibly be like Bichleng must be the boss, basically, to have a rule like that. Because that sounds
Calls are blocked.
Yeah, that's pretty bizarre. Kat says, I work for a contractor at Anglo, and I'm currently on 5 WhatsApp groups for work. I hate it. Yeah. You see, we keep creating new groups instead of using the old ones, because sometimes you can't remember what the old one's called. And then, like, a group will pop up. I'll be like, who's on this group again? I'll have to go and check who's on there. And then I don't know what's going on, so I'm with you. That's, like, crazy. 5 groups. So that's pretty wild. Natalie says, I just put all my notifications off. Then I'm in control of what I want to look at. It takes a bit of self-control, but mentally it works for me. Nats. See, again, like I like hearing what everybody's different strategies are for dealing with this stuff, because you can't be on all the time. There's no way. It just exhausts you. And as Sia said, it'll give you massive anxiety when your phone isn't with you or you're not connected. Mm-hmm. And what made me think of it, Sia, was you talking about just having dinner last night without the TV on.
Yeah. I'm a bunch of contradictions. I'll complain about something, but then also in 2 seconds, I'll say something totally contradictory. I also have these breaking alerts that I've subscribed to for Twitter I just need to know what is happening. It even alerts me on a tweet that has a lot of retweets, so maybe like 200 retweets. That means something of substance. Oof. Some of the time. No. Sometimes it just means it's a very funny meme. But I need to know what it is, because what if someone famous has died and then tomorrow we need to do a tribute for them on the show? What if
what's the worst that can happen? We'll be late with the news. Blah, big deal.
Yes.
Twitter's one of those, like, for me, when I log on to Twitter and I see what is trending, then I'm like, oh, okay, this is what's going on. Oh, this is who they're talking about now. This is what people are saying. And then when I'm out. Like, I don't even care if I'm missing out on the latest trending topic. I'm good. I'm great. I'm awesome. Like, bye. See ya.
I'm exactly on Simpua's page on that one. I could care less what's going on Twitter. And frankly, it has never improved my life or made me feel any better. So don't give a shit. Never have.
I heard first that George Michael died.
So?
Yeah, so I get all my breaking news from Twitter.
So what?
You know, like...
You know, if I'm interested, like, I'll go on Twitter when I need to know what the news is.
I know, nothing.
But some people, they really take this stuff super seriously, you know? And I don't think it's necessary. Like, in any previous time in human history, you would have found out the news weeks after it had happened if it was far away. Weeks.
God.
Like, you know, the guy from the next door village would have to run to your village to tell you that someone had died. You'd be like, oh, my God. And he'd be like, that was 2 weeks ago. It took me a long time to get here.
See, that's the only time I wish I was born way back when. Because I feel like I would have been that person with a wheelbarrow delivering newspapers. Like, hey, girl, did you hear?
No, Sarah. Please stop glorifying the struggle.
I feel like I would have been the TMZ of the Regency era.
I would have been the lady whistledown
of Bridgerton. Lady Slytherin was caught with her garter down. You are a girl. Let me plug you in.
Picture live.
Well,
No. I'm here for the social media and digital age. Like, I'm sorry.
Well,
No.
Precisely that is something we've got to talk about in the next half hour. And we've also got JJ Cornish joining us. He will tell us what's going on in Africa and African analysis, which is coming up in the next half hour as well. But one thing we've got to talk about is the Please Call Me Inventor. You know, Nkosana Makate, who's refused a 46 million rand payoff offered by Vodacom. He says he deserves more than 10 billion rand. He's not interested in 46 million rand. He wants 10 billion rand. So that's pretty hardcore. He's saying no. I mean, 46 million rand.
It's a lot of money.
I would take it. Yeah, I would say but sure. Let's go.
I don't know, but I mean, he's been fighting for like 20 years. And then like in 2016, I think he won the case.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, he'll get like a portion of the profits. I think they agreed on 20%.
Sure.
And now that's what he's disputing, that it's not worth 46 million. It's actually worth over 10 billion rand. And they're saying that Vodacom made like 205 billion rand in the time frame. So that's what he's like, if you're giving me 46 meter, look, I don't want it. I want 10 billion. And I'm just so intrigued.
I'm very intrigued. I think he's got a good argument. And I don't know what the right advice is here, because you know, his legal team could say to him, listen, this $46 million will cover your costs of all your legal fees up to now, because it has been a long time, and you'll get some money to retire on. Or you keep fighting and there's a chance you could lose and then you get nothing. You know, or you could win and get like R1 billion or something. Who knows? So
yeah,
it's
I'm here for the fight. I'm here for this energy.
Really?
I was reading the article and he says that, you know, he feels that he's going to win this one. So shout out to him. Like if he wins $10 billion, I'm going to be like props, eh? Props.
Okay. All right.
Like if he wins $10 billion, then I'm his long lost cousin.
Yeah.
I mean, surely we are related somewhere.
Can you believe what a gold digger Sia is, you know?
Oh.
I mean, I'm not mad. No one wants to live in struggle, you know? We all want the soft, crisp, nice life. So I understand where Sia's coming from.
No,
you
sure.
Know?
No,
let's not glorify struggle, no.
I hear you.
You know?
This is what the show has taught me over the past few weeks. It has actually made me realize more how superficial my ways are than what I realized.
Yes.
Because, wow.
You're an embarrassment.
Even just that comment. It's normal in my head, though, Gareth. That's the thing. It's normal.
You know what? Embrace your shallowness here. Go with it.
I would have found no problem to go research the guy, find out from Facebook where he grew up, particularly his high school crush, the one night they had sex. I would have convinced him that actually I came.
We're together.
From that.
We belong together.
So let's get to some headlines.
What's his name? My future daddy. What's his name?
Nkosana Makate.
Nkosana. My second name is Nkosentle.
There we go. All right, so let's get to some headlines while Sia plans his gold-digging future. In Durban, firefighters have had their hands full for all of yesterday, battling a blaze that started in the early hours of the morning in Overport. It's not known what caused the fire. It ripped through two buildings. Although no loss of life has been reported, a firefighter was injured in the blaze. Authorities are still investigating the cause of the fire. That's in Durban, and that was yesterday. In ANC news, Cyril Ramaphosa has condemned threats against Jesse Duarte for carrying out ANC instructions. How's this? So you suspend Ace Magashule and then people threaten to kill you for instituting those decisions of the NEC. So African National Congress President Cyril Ramaphosa said the party had reaffirmed its Deputy Secretary General Jesse Duarte, who's taking over Ace's duties, right? That they've condemned threats and insults hurled at her and other Luthuli House staffers for carrying out instructions to suspend members who refused to step aside. In his closing address following the weekend's NEC meeting, he said that the meeting of the party's highest decision-making structure in between conferences had noted death threats being made against their NEC coordinator, Andre Snell. The ANC's leadership has been caught in factional battles with the party's suspended Secretary-General Ace Magashule unilaterally issuing a suspension against Ramaphosa, which he's been instructed to apologize for. It's just a mess. It's a mess. What can we say? Disaster. ANC is a disaster. And then Saudi Arabia says the Hajj pilgrimage will be held this year. So for many Muslims, the pilgrimage is the most important thing that they undertake, one of the pillars of Islam, a visit to Mecca, to the Kaaba. And they say that the Hajj is back on this year. It's not clear whether foreign nationals will be allowed into Saudi Arabia to be part of this year's event, but they say they've met the health and safety requirements for the gathering. It attracts millions of people from around the world. For the past 2 years, the pilgrimage to Mecca was reduced to only a few thousand, and they may be opening it up again.
Hmm.
You know, you've got to...
Because there's...
Yeah, go ahead.
You are right up and close in each other.
Oh, hell yeah. And it's a million
people. There's no social distancing there.
No, sure. And you circle the Kaaba, which is, you know what the Kaaba is meant to be? It's meant to be the original house that Abraham lived in. Abraham. The same Abraham in the Christian and the Jewish religious texts was his house. And there's a stone in the corner of the Kaaba, which is supposed to have been the stone that God decided to start the world on. It's like the navel of the world. essentially. Wow. Very, very interesting stuff, yeah. Then a dark side group, how does that sound? A dark side group is behind ransomware and the hacking of the U.S. Colonial Pipeline. So this is a really complicated story, but I'll try and reduce it to something simple to you. The FBI on Monday said ransomware for the shadowy dark side group, which basically shut down a pipeline. It's a major fuel pipeline. They just stopped it from working. So all of this fuel couldn't go through, you know, a third of America's states to supply them with fuel. And it was all done by this organization called DarkSide. And they're reopening the 5,500 miles of pipeline between Texas and New York after hackers locked it down its corporate IT systems on Friday, apparently demanding a significant amount of money in ransom. You've got to be careful. That stuff's going on. It's going on all around us.
So did they hackers. Pay the ransom?
No, they didn't. They managed to cool. figure it out, which is, you know, it's interesting, but it's not. It's obviously these guys, the U.S. government also employs a bunch of hackers who can then out-hack the hackers who tried to hack into the pipeline. That's the only way to beat hackers is to bring your own hackers in. So the Queen has reemerged to outline the U.K.'s new government agenda. Queen Elizabeth II on Tuesday makes her first public appearance as the funeral of her late husband, Prince Philip, to open a new session of Parliament and present her newly victorious government's post-pandemic legislative agenda. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is riding high after the Conservatives' triumph last week in the local and regional elections in England, but faces new questions over their cohesion because there's a pro-independence force in Scotland which emerged on top, the Scottish National Party. So Boris Johnson says his government, after overseeing a successful inoculation campaign against COVID-19, is intent on reopening the economy and determined that we look forward and get on with fulfilling the promises we've made to the British people. So the Queen's going to pitch up and make a speech to Parliament, which is basically, you know, Boris Johnson's agenda.
Huh.
All right.
In a slight tangent, I got stuck in the weirdest royal YouTube rabbit hole over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Somehow I ended up watching this conversation between Dame Judi Dench and Camilla on the most random and arbitrary topics. It was filmed like last year sometime. But the two of them, it's like a being a fly on the wall on Ladies Who Lunch, but then also it's like, wait a minute, Camilla, she's royal. What is she talking about? Yeah. But she goes, I've never used the internet before this. It's just so complicated. Okay, but she was so chuffed with herself that she could Camilla. Zoom and she could like do things like that and go, oh. Arma Camilla, shame
only
man.
Sia, you're the only person who could sit through a conversation between Dame Judi Dench and Camilla. Only you, Sia.
It's quite sad, but I loved it.
Well, I told you, I think Camilla's fantastic. Everybody loves Princess Diana, you know, but she, I find Camilla's like the real hero in the story. That's real love. I've said it a million times. All right, here's something interesting. Bees GTA Online says, Gareth, last week, you showed us a video of an attempted CIT heist that was foiled. Remember that guy, Leo, who drove that that vehicle so amazingly, managed to evade these guys. He was shot at. You could see the bullet marks on the bulletproof glass. It was a really scary video to watch. Anyway, he says, Leo had to be pulled out of service due to receiving death threats from Tsotsis. That guy has been threatened, apparently. I know that's old news for some of us, but thank you for that, B. It's a very ugly scenario. I mean, here's a guy who's doing the right thing. He's managed to save his and his co-driver's life, or his passenger's life, and now he's getting death threats from all the gangsters who tried to steal that stuff he was transporting. So it just shows you what a screwed-up country we live in. Yeah. Here we go with Sia and other people's money, says Mpihleng. Yeah, of course. Sia thinks he's entitled to a piece of other people's money. Corona's Boring says, I think a large problem society is facing is sensory overload. We're bombarded with so much information so often, it is almost impossible to determine what's truth and what's not, i.e. UFOs. Absolutely. That's part of why we have to...
Don't get Gareth started on this again.
I'm not going down the UFO path, I promise you. I'm just thinking...
Okay.
Part of the problem we have is that we're constantly bombarded with information. What Coronis Boring says is sensory overload. Absolutely true. And so if everything's coming at you, it's hard to determine what's important and what isn't. Therence says, if you're sending emails at 2 a.m., you have an issue with time management. I agree. Good point, well put. So that's a useful bit of info. Anyway, we were talking just before the news about this Please Call Me inventor who is refusing 46 million rand that's been offered by Vodacom and says he deserves more than 10 billion rand. As Simpiwe says, Vodacom supposedly made some 200 billion rand out of the Please Call Me device, which is, you know, a useful way for people who don't have money on their phones to let people who do have money on their phones pay for them so they can get in contact. We've all used Please Call Me at some point, and he invented it, supposedly, and he's claiming this money. Clearly, he's got a case, otherwise they wouldn't have offered him 46 million in the first place, right? And he has been going on about this for years now. It's been at least 15, maybe 20 years that they've been fighting. But what do you do? I mean, what's the best strategy? So Simpiwe says she's in for the fight. She would be going for that 10 billion. And
well, with my meager, and I really, really mean meager, knowledge of court proceedings and posturing that takes place in court, this to me sounds like, and wouldn't you agree, Garrett, it sounds like something his legal team would have presented, and they really aren't gunning for 10 billion. They kind of want just to stake their claim more, and they're probably going to settle for way less. But it's just this to show how confident they are in their case. And he'll probably be happy with a couple of more million.
Yeah, well, listen, I don't know. I mean, how much will be enough? So here's the deal. The scary part of this is that the lawyers will probably cost him 46 million rand.
Yeah.
Considering how long it's been going
after,
on. Well, I mean, so he'll come out with zero if he settles at 46 million. So he's probably looking at this going, sounds like a lot of money. But his legal fees could easily be half of that, maybe even up to 46 million. You never know. I mean, like, lawyers are really expensive, you know. And if the case has been dragging on as long as it has, it's entirely possible that he could come out of this with very little. So maybe it's worth fighting for more. Of course, if you do go for more, there's a chance you will win nothing. And then you'll still be liable for those legal fees. That's his worst. So the worst case scenario for this Nkosana Makate is that he goes for more, ends up getting nothing or less than, you know, 10 million, not 10 billion, but 10 million. Then he has to foot the bill for all his lawyers and he gets no money out. How's that? That would be terrifying. And then, of course, the best.
I think he'd be happy with like 150 million.
Oh, sure. I mean, listen, what's the difference? If you've got 10 million rand and you've got 100 million rand, what's the difference, really? Like, if you're in the clear, you don't owe anyone money, and you've got 10 million rand in the bank, or you've got 100 million rand in the bank, what difference does
you
that really make?
You are set for life.
You pretty much are. I mean, listen,
set.
A lot of people will say, oh, 10 million is not a lot of money. Please, show me someone who's got no debts and who's got 10 million rand in the bank, and I'll show you a rich person. And
what I want to know is when you go on like a case like this, because over the 20 years, I'm presuming that it's not like he has like a whole lot of cash to pay his lawyers. So what happens when it's been dragging on for so long? Like, do the lawyers be like, no, we'll just invoice you once this is done? Or are they like, we take a portion of how much you make? So what happens when it's like, interested in.
I think considering how long this has been dragging on, I think what's happened is they're not billing him in hours. They're probably going to say to him, we'll do what you just said in the second option. It's called contingency. So what the lawyers will do in that case is they'll say, if you win the case, we're taking 25, 30% of the money.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, he'll decide with them. They'll sit down and they'll negotiate. He'll say to them, I'll give you, if you guys can do this for me, if you can give me 1 billion rand, I'll give you 30%. You know, that would be a really good
fee.
That's fair. And then they work extra hard because they know there's a big payday coming. If they're charging him by the hour, he better win. That's what I'm going to say. He better win because it's like a charging like a wounded buffalo. That's what lawyers do. All right. It is time for us to get to Africanalysis. And joining us by audio from Pretoria is none other than Jean-Jacques Cornish. Bonjour, Jean-Jacques. Nice to see you again or hear you again. How are you?
I'm exceedingly well, thanks. I'm actually calling you from Limpopo.
Oh.
I came up here on a story which has not materialized. You know, the locals are having a go at the Chinese mm-hmm. about this economic zone that they're trying to build up near Messina. They're meeting today or is expecting fireworks, and it's not happening. So I've stopped in Sanin and spent the night here, and I'll be heading back to the capital of the Freedom-Loving People's Republic later today.
So, Jean-Jacques, it is time for an update on all the other things that are going on in Africa. I had no idea about this issue with the Chinese and the people of Messina, but we'll find out, no doubt, in the next couple of months how much of a non-story it is, because we know that China's influence in South Africa and in Africa is growing. But let's turn our attention to the rest of the continent. It's brought to you, Africanalysis, by the Johannesburg Business School, and we're looking at all the things that are going on our continent. Can we start off in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo? What's happening there?
Well, Felix Tshisekedi, the president, is the current president of the African Union, current chairman of the African Union, and he started a negotiation with one of our favorite stories, the Blue Nile Dam, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. He started negotiating or mediating between Ethiopia, filling that dam, Sudan and Egypt downstream, who believe that it is an existential danger to them, that they will get less of the Nile water and on which they absolutely rely for survival. And he started in April and nothing happened. Now, our own president, when he was chairman of the African Union last year, Cyril Ramaphosa, he had a bash at it and nothing happened for him either. So now Tshisekedi has gone to Sudan and to Egypt and will end up in Ethiopia trying very hard to get some movement on this. It's a huge story, and there's no doubt that if there is any kind of actual conflict, a fighting war in Africa, it's going to be over that. That is my prediction. Now, at the same time, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeff Feltman, he's in Africa at the moment talking also about things on Somalia, and but certainly the great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is the story or the biggest story in Africa for the year.
You know, you think about that, the Nile River is such a it's been the aorta, it's been the main blood vessel of you know, civilization in North Africa since the dawn of civilization. I mean, ancient Egypt relied on the annual flooding of the Nile for its own survival and for its eventual flourishing. If we think about how long that Nile River has provided sustenance to the people of the north of this continent, it's just incredible. And now, according to the Egyptians anyway and the Sudanese, this is a real threat to them. How much of a threat do you think it actually is? When you consider the geography, when you consider Ethiopia's ambitions in that part of the continent, how much of it is just political grandstanding, and how much of it could actually be an existential threat, as you put it, to the people of Egypt?
Well, you know, really interesting that. I loved it when I was coming up here, traveling up the road, that you go past this area called Nail's Flay, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because when the trek were coming up, they said, you know, we have come this far. This, and they found the eye of a river. This must be the Nile. And that's what they called it, the Nile. I mean, it's thousands of kilometers south of where it really is. But it's a massive river. I've been to that confluence in Khartoum of the Blue and White Niles.
Right.
And to see that mixture, it's quite an amazing river. The most interesting thing is analysts saying that, in fact, the real beneficiaries of the Nile in Egypt are the upper classes, and that the poorer people don't benefit, that the agriculture and so on all belongs to the upper classes in Egypt, and that the existential threat is to the upper classes in Egypt. So it's interesting that, but the fact is, the Nile comes down in flood and it leaves this sort of alluvial deposit, and that's what the Egyptians grow their crops on.
Right.
Now, if that flood doesn't occur, then their agriculture is going to be seriously affected. So it is a major thing. Of course, the Sudanese they have other water, but they believe that the Nile, by controlling the flooding, they might be doing them a favor. But again, they worry about access to this enormous amount of water on which the vast majority of the population survive.
It's incredible. So I'm fascinated that the DRC president is now the head of the AU, and that he's the guy who has to go and deal with this. But there are also lots of discussions, since we're in Northern Europe, about migration. And we know that, you know, Europe, this is the biggest question at the moment. North Africa and Europe are locked in an argument over how many migrants should be allowed, whether or not migrants should be allowed at all. Migrants are taking matters into their own hands and climbing onto whatever they can to try and cross the Mediterranean. We know that often they're turned back. There are many situations where these people capsize in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea and drown. It's a very ugly scenario. But better weather seems to have an effect on this too, right, JJ?
Yes, indeed. As the summer comes, or the late spring, people feel more inclined to get onto these boats.
Mm-hmm.
And, they give up their lives to get onto them. And they come over mostly from Libya, and some from Tunisia. I remember when I was in Tunisia for the elections, I went to speak to people about voting, and there were these young people in this cafe, and it turned out that they were going to meet people smugglers.
Hmm.
And I said to them, but you know, you're taking your life in your hands doing it. You're young people. You're all highly qualified. Right. Why don't you just make a life for yourself in your own country? And they said, there's no employment here. There's nothing we can do. This is our only option, is to go and find a way in Europe. And while I was there, 11 people drowned just off the coast where I was. It was so sad. And this is happening all the time. Now, Lampedusa, from Tunisia, from Tunis, in fact, you can look out and see. You can see parts of Sicily.
Wow.
You can visually see it.
Yeah.
Now, Lampedusa is an island very close to Libya, and that's where so many of them arrive. And 1,000 arrived on Sunday. 1,000.
Sure.
So far, there have been 11,000 this year. Now, that's less than the 4,000 last year, but it's not anywhere near the 2015 peak that arrived at the time. Now, we had this appalling Interior Secretary Matteo Salvini, who was stopping all the boats and not allowing even rescued people to land. He's now been charged at the International Court of ICC for kidnapping, for actually forcing people to stay aboard a boat when they risk their lives doing it. So he's been charged, but he's making much of the sudden arrival of people and demanding a meeting with the interim premier, you know, Mario Draghi, trying to improve his case.
Do they send?
He's got legal problems.
Do they send people home? I mean, what do they do? Do they assimilate most of these people into the population? Do they put them into refugee centers? Do they provide them with sustenance? Do they give them, social security, so to speak? Or do they send them away?
Well, they can't send them away once they land in Lampedusa. Basically, what has happened is the EU has paid the Libyans a lot of money to get them to effectively coast guard and to send boats back, or they get nearer to Italy and to Europe, Malta and other countries. And the fact is there, when that happens, they send them into camps in Libya, where we've had stories even of people being sold into slavery. So it's not really a humane solution.
We don't even have much of a government in Libya at the moment, do we?
No, not at all. I mean, it really is an anarchistic state. They have elections coming up, and one hopes that it's going to improve. But it's not only Libya. That's something about our continent, that the people are so desperate to leave it that they're prepared to take their lives in their hands. And, you know, literally tens of thousands have died trying to get across. They come from Morocco and then they go into Spain. That's mm-hmm. why Spain and Morocco at the moment having another row. We'll talk about it another stage, mm-hmm. All over the West Sahara. They come from Morocco across the short Gibraltar Straits into Spain. They come from Tunisia again, where they go into Italy. So it's a desperate situation, and one that the Europeans are trying so hard to get to stem this flow of migrants. But at the moment, you know, there's tens of thousands coming through every year, and there's very little they can do about it. And on humanitarian grounds, once they land, they can't send them back.
Keep them, yeah. So it becomes Europe's problem. The mismanagement of and the desperation of Africa becomes Europe's problem ultimately. But let's leave that alone for a second because we've got time for one more thing before you go. You mentioned elections in Libya, but there are also elections that are meant to be happening in Ethiopia this year. Are those going to go ahead?
Yes. Well, they were postponed from August last year because of COVID. And now they've been postponed until a couple of weeks' time, June the 5th. But now I'm hearing that they're really struggling to conclude that, and there may be another postponement. There's 31 and nearly 32 million voters, and you know, it's Africa's second most populous country after Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So it's very important for Abiy Ahmed, who of course is our Nobel Peace Prize winning premier in Africa. What happened in Tigray, you know, on the 4th of November last year, there were the attacks on Tigray, and then he desperate to quell that, has taken really punitive measures against the people of Tigray. He's facing human rights charges and legal charges. Right. And then he also has Oromo, the ethnic area that he himself comes from. And they won't be voting in Tigray for sure. And it looks like in Oromo it's not going to happen. So he has grown up problems himself of trying to get properly re-elected. I mean, his government, which had international acclaim, suddenly at home is under siege. And so it's a very interesting situation. When I say interesting, I'm using thing in the Chinese context. It's like a curse.
Well, JJ, always good to catch up with you. You know things that the rest of us don't until we hear from you, and it's much appreciated that you can fill us in on the goings-on of our own continent, even if they're so far north that the old Voortrekkers would have thought that they had hit the origin of the Nile, Nylstroom. So thank you so much for making it back from Limpopo, or still being there and heading back, and we'll keep in touch with you and find out what else we can learn in the next couple of days on Africanalysis. That's JJ Cornish and Africanalysis, which is brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. Always interesting to talk to him. It is 7 o'clock. It is Tuesday. Don't forget, I haven't forgotten that we've got to do the one thing for the week. That's coming up in the next hour. And we've also got blind history and a whole lot more. Simpiwe Mtetwa and Sia Sangweni are here with us. And you are the most important guest this morning. So thank you for waking up and keeping us company on this Tuesday. CliffCentral.com